All right, it's 2 p.m. Stay tuned for Naturalistic Support coming up. WBAI New York.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to Naturalistic Support. I'm Arnell Doray. Joining me today is Elaine Durbach.
Hi, Arnell.
Hey, Elaine. Naturalistic Support is a new approach to lasting personal growth and healthier, more satisfying relationships. Combining a progressive understanding of our human experience with peer support, on this program, we help each other. And that happens when you call us to talk about yourselves as well as to talk to each other. Our number is 212-209-2877. And today, our topic is surviving tribalism. In-group and out-group dynamics and the larger phenomenon of tribalism have been with humankind for millennia, yet never before have they posed the existential threat that they do today. How can humankind resolve its differences before it's too late? And how can naturalistic humanism help? We look forward to you joining the discussion with us. But first,
Arnell, can I?
Yeah.
This resonates with me because I think we're facing all kinds of deep and fierce divisions at the moment, especially in this country.
Yeah.
Maybe in others as well. On the other hand, I keep looking at my Facebook feed and seeing these messages from people all over the world. I'm thinking in some ways we've got more bridges and more connection than humanity's ever had before.
Yeah. In some ways we do, but I think that the net effect, at least so far, of social media has been to do more to atomize us and to, divide us and put us into these extreme corners.
Yeah, there's that too.
Yeah, I do think that what you're bringing up is a countervailing force, that it's a lot easier for people also to connect, but the flip side of that is it's a lot easier for people to connect over ideas that are completely toxic.
Yeah, and because they're not face to face, it seems to get more aggressive.
Yeah, absolutely. Elaine, could you read a little bit about tribalism?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's frequently assumed that tribalism and in-group favoritism, or in-group versus out-group bias, is a basic human trait. There are, however, several reasons to question the extent to which such bias resulted in violent conflict between our early human ancestors. In his recent book, Humankind, A Hopeful History, the Dutch historian Rutger Bregman argues that based on the available evidence prior to the age of permanent settlements, agriculture, surplus, and the concomitant social stratification, violent conflict between human groups encountering one another was actually rare. Determining the degree of violence between hunter-gatherer groups with accuracy, however, is fraught with difficulty due to insufficient evidence and disagreement among experts, but it does seem reasonable to infer that when groups of early humans encountered each other, there was probably intense curiosity and excitement. the value of two groups exchanging knowledge and information, trading tools, commodities, adornments, along with the opportunity for mating with new and different partners, is probably what most defines such encounters. There might have been periods of intense resource scarcity when one group's access to an alienable resource, in other words, a resource which could be taken, would result in conflict. But the evidence suggests that such events were infrequent.
So let's just stop for a second right there, because, you know, we have this belief that things have always been tribal, in-group, out-group, and, you know, and violence toward out-groups is just a fact of life. But it really seems like there's a lot of reason to question whether that was what life was like for our ancient ancestors long before settlements arose, when we were still mobile, when we were still nomadic, when we were hunter-gatherers. The anthropological record really doesn't suggest that you had war or you had necessarily, you know, great violence. But, I mean, there were punctuated periods when there obviously were conflict, and, you know, we can assume that those most likely correlate with resource scarcity. But really, if you think about what an ancient tribe, a nomadic tribe, meeting strangers for the first time, what they might want to do, they might want to do a lot more than just kill each other, right? Yeah, they might want to exchange information and jewelry and techniques and something that was unique to where they were coming from and where the other group was coming from, and most of all, the, you know, having new mates to procreate with, that was, you know, that was a big draw, and you don't get that if you're killing everybody.
Although that's also, as we know, a potential for competition and aggression. If you're competing for mates.
Yeah.
Just wondering about the parallels with the animal world.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
What do you think? Oh, they definitely guard their brood or their mates or their hunting grounds.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we see every kind of behavior in the animal world, right? We see unbelievably cooperative behaviors, and we also see some pretty fiercely competitive ones. You know, in the animal world, there's evidence that, I mean, we know that there are birds that will wreck the constructions of other birds because that home that one bird built might reduce the other bird's chances of finding a mate. So by wrecking it, then that kind of evens the playing field. And things like that. We know there are animals that will kill the young of, you know, another male.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that they can reproduce. All of that, I think there's reason to think that all of that probably took place in ancient human experience. But the more that we started to, I think, separate from our animal past, the less necessary those kind, you know, the more destructive and destabilizing and I think undesirable those kinds of behaviors were, and the more that there was a social structure to protect people and to establish what's acceptable behavior, the more that probably became reduced and until it really diminished to minuscule amounts.
When you think how complex the interactions became and how much specialization began to happen. You know, one group of people doing one kind of work and the other group doing the other kind, and needing each other to cooperate so that they could build these more secure, more comfortable environments.
Yeah, and just things like, you know, cooperative hunting. So many things that cooperation made possible, that if people were as brutal and tribal and as parochial as we kind of imagine they might have been, it would really impede a lot of the progress that was possible by diversity coming in, it being exposed to diversity from different groups coming together.
So tell me, from a naturalistic point of view, how do you see this? Given that, you know, given that basic assumption that we are the sum total of everything that is added up to us, how does naturalistic support approach this issue?
Well, I think that we have to recognize that things that we've done, that humankind have been doing for a long, long time. You know, let's say that there's listeners out there that are hearing this discussion and they're saying, you know, Arnell, you must be tripping. Humans have been, you know, rabidly tribal and in-group, out-group. Favoritism is, you know, in our DNA. And, you know, the fact that you're not recognizing this makes me worried about you. I mean, I have gotten that from people. But the thing is, no matter, let's say that I say, okay, fine, I concede. The archaeological record is, and the anthropological record is contested. It's not agreed. We really can't say definitively what life was like 100,000 years ago. But let's say this. Even if brutal tribalism and in-group, out-group competition and favoritism is as basic to our history as some people think, it doesn't matter going forward, because if we keep it going forward, if we can't outgrow this now, we are so screwed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We are just totally screwed. Humankind is not going to survive this. We've been able to survive this when all we had was rocks to throw at each other. We've been able to survive it with sticks and you know, with bows and arrows and, you know, other kinds of not mass killing machines. But
yeah, and we basically didn't compete with anybody we couldn't see.
Yeah. So, you know, we are in a period now where either we're going to find a way past these behaviors, or we're going to we're not going to see the future. We're going to destroy each other. That's the choices. The choices aren't, you know, do we just keep on going like this because we say it's in our DNA? Maybe it would be nice if we didn't. It's not that it would be nice. If we can't stop the tribalism, then given the existential threats that we're juggling between environmental collapse and nuclear annihilation, we're not going to survive it. Whether humankind will still be here in 100 years or not will partially, significantly turn on the degree to which we can think globally.
Do you remember when Chernobyl happened?
Yeah.
To me, that was one of the real wake-ups, that there was this, you know, evil empire that we regarded as the enemy. But when a nuclear catastrophe happened, the wind and the air and the currents that blew that toxic waste didn't care where our boundaries were.
Absolutely.
And there was an amazing international coming together of attempts to contain it.
Yeah. And that's what it's going to take. I mean, we're not going to fix the climate, you know, by, you know, one country doing some insufficient thing and another country doing a different insufficient thing. We need to act globally and think globally. To act globally, we have to think globally. We have to recognize that we've got a lot to unite us, because either we hang together or we hang separately.
Yeah. What do you think about the next generation? Do you think the young are coming at this from a different point of view, that they have, you know, do they see things in a more international or a more connected way because they do share so much culture globally?
Well, goodness, we can only hope so. But, you know, we know that young people are suffering isolation. You know, they're suffering great anxiety. They're suffering psychological displacement because of, you know, the emergence of artificial intelligence that will be making so much of what we've been telling them to study and prepare for obsolete.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like people who, you know, good advice for a young person used to be, I have one word for you, and it's not plastics, it's computers.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so learn how to code was, you know, the watchwords that we said to young people for 20 years. And now we're like, well, yeah, not so much.
Yeah, we've got these machines that can do the coding.
Yeah.
You're not needed.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that young people are facing conditions that when you and I were young, as we were once, hard to remember though, but it was a different world. And, you know, so just put it this way, it's a lot to expect from any generation to cope with the destabilized world that we're handing them. But, you know, that's where naturalistic support can help. If we, you know, imagine a young person that's raised to not blame others and not blame themselves, and to understand that the way people behave is the only way they can behave given the determinants that led up to a given moment. And, you know, that judgmental thinking clouds our ability to see clearly. And if we can pass those values on to young people, I do think that can make a difference. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's I think there's incredible potential there, and I think we're already seeing a lot of that happening.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which is the stronger force, but I like what you wrote about this, that the systems that have created racial and ethnic conflict and discrimination and violence, which in some ways are being fanned at the moment.
Yeah.
But they're also coming up against all of these other issues that smooth out the differences.
Yes. But, you know, let's first get to that by, kind of picking up. We were talking about what life might have been like for our ancient ancestors, but in the period between then and now, tribalism really did emerge as a major way to divide people for elites.
It was in fact a tool of oppression, a tool of power.
Yeah, you know, it's something that Rhian Eisler calls domination culture. She's an anthropologist. We actually had her on as a guest on our parent program, Equal Time for Free Thought. We were getting a little clicking, Elaine. I think that might have come from your end, just so you know.
Nothing happening here?
Nothing now, but I'll tell you when we hear it, then we can maybe track it down. Yeah, I just heard a little bit. Okay. The tribalism, you know, it's kind of been... See, that was a... Okay, that's that click. It just did that.
Nothing happening here.
Okay. So, Reg, we don't know what that is. Because nothing happening here either. All right. The tribalism and the in-group, out-group favoritism arose with the acquisition of surplus and the emergence of an elite class deploying divisive narratives to redirect popular grievance. So, while today many people do hate and fear those they consider to be the out-group, there's no reason to assume that such reactions are basic to our human nature. By showing how blame is unjustified and unproductive, naturalistic humanism gives us an effective counter-narrative to tribalistic tropes and rationales for in-group favoritism. And, you know, there's a natural, I mean, when we think about who is our in-group, we're going through a major change throughout the world. You know, there's this pop culture that we've all participated in and continue to be very influenced by. And that's redrawing the lines of traditional in-group, out-group divisions. For example, imagine how many grandchildren of or great-grandchildren of immigrants feel more connected to their grandparents' cultural identity than to the pop culture of their peers. You know, very few.
Yeah, very few. That's a very good point.
So, I mean, that's where we're headed. But let's hear from listeners. Our number is 212-209-2877. And we'd like to hear what you think about in-group, out-group bias and tribalism. Historically, domination systems in the United States and in the Western world in general have resulted in numerous racial and ethnic groups being subject to discrimination, oppression, and violence as experienced by many groups of immigrants, enslavement as experienced by millions of captured Africans, and even zealously executed programs of extermination as experienced by Native Americans, European Jews, Armenians, and Russian peasants. Over time, as new technologies and art forms made possible increasingly effective ways to share our human stories, our empathetic sensibility expanded. Today, massive numbers of people are aware of the historic oppression that occurred, and its many lingering effects, and the way society continues to bestow privilege to some at the expense of others. Ideally, our increased sensitivity to how our social economic system and culture has been, and in many ways remains, injurious, should weaken the divide and conquer mechanism at the heart of the domination system. But ironically, instead, we're experiencing a period of intensive social, political, and cultural fragmentation.
It's really ironic that it's working that way, but perhaps possible that this is going to intensify our awareness and our understanding of the risks involved in this kind of fragmentation? You think so?
We could only hope so. Let's see what one of our listeners who just called in thinks. Let's see. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling and where are you calling from?
My name is Denise. I'm calling from Brooklyn.
Hey, Denise.
I hope that... How are you? I'm I'm going to talk fast because I'm going to get ready to go to another location.
Okay.
The focus is not on fundamentals. And that's where the real problem stems from. You said something about fragmentation. If we allow certain entities to fragment our way of thinking, that's where all the problems stem from.
Yes.
Human beings are a type of entity. That's sort of like a clan or whatever. We are a type of entity that needs certain things in order to survive just on an individual basis. And the most common and most familiar need is the survival of self. If we could start to focus on fundamentals, a lot of the nonsense would just fall to the side. Example, we are destroying our air,
yeah,
our water, and our food. These are items that are absolutely required to continue existing. But because our train of thought is fragmented and distracted, there are certain entities that are able to distract us from that fact and allow us to fight amongst each other instead of trying to make sure that the things that we require in order to just exist perpetuate.
Yeah. No, absolutely, Denise. Thank you.
Really well put.
Thank you. Thank you. No, that's absolutely well put. And absolutely, you know, she's really hitting what the challenge is. You know, groups that have survived a history of violent oppression or attempted genocide often react to their ordeal by developing an ever deeper connection to their traditional tribal identities. And that's, you know, obviously completely understandable. You know, after surviving the Holocaust, large numbers of Jewish people who had previously chosen mainstream assimilation re-embraced their tribal identity in ways ranging from extremist Zionism to practicing highly Orthodox Judaism to other less extreme but nonetheless tribal Jewish identification. Having been violently torn away from their African roots, many American blacks have been reorienting themselves toward a renewed connection to African culture in a variety of ways, including wearing African fabrics like kente cloth and dashikis and head wraps, embracing African music and dance, and in naming practices, where since the 1960s, many black children have been given African, African-oriented, or Muslim-related names. Among the descendants of Native Americans who struggled against genocide and cultural obliteration, there's also a movement deeply committed to maintaining tribal identities, including customs and language. These groups' resistance to the dominating culture's hegemonic efforts to destroy their cultural, religious, ethnic, and/or racial identities is completely understandable and admirable. But in our modern world, strong tribal identities pose numerous challenges. And we see
exactly
that
exactly the dilemma.
Yeah, that's the dilemma, and we see that from history. Give us a call. Tell us what you think, listeners. Our number is 212-209-2877, and let's take our halfway break, and we'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Naturalistic Support
right here on 99.5 FM
WBAI New York.
Non-commercial, listener sponsored.
Peace and Justice Radio.
On Wednesdays from 2 to 3, Naturalistic Support is taking listener calls, offering a revolutionary new way to think about ourselves and reach out to each other.
I just wanted to call in to give encouragement to the last
appallers to hit right on where I am right at this moment.
You really hit the proverbial nail on the head.
I really connected with what you were saying about loneliness.
We are hardwired to help each other.
Getting past the blame, owning your own truth, letting go of judgmental thoughts.
I felt so fortunate to hear this.
You went through every single one of the things that I've been working on for my life. Now you said all that, I'm like, holy cow, what is this guy doing? Is he talking to me right now?
The Naturalistic Revolution is a game changer. Listen to us break it down on Wednesdays from 2 to 3.
I want to thank you so much. You helped me so much.
We're back. This is Naturalistic Support. I'm Arnel Doray, and joining me is Elaine Durbach. And we are talking about tribalism and how we're going to survive that, how we're going to find our way to a healthy globalism that can empower us to solve the problems that are looming. And I believe we have another caller on the line. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling? Where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Dave. I'm calling from Queens.
Hey, Dave.
So I just wanted to say one of the most intriguing things about human nature is the ability to tolerate and adapt to conditions, especially very harsh conditions, and tolerate them. And I think that's indicative, whether you look at any continent or any country or any type of people. Look at Rwanda and the Congo. The Tutsis were massacred, and now they are, you know, on the other side, and they are, you know, causing terrible harm and pain and death to their former perpetrators. We also here in America, as you said, we grew up at a time that was very simple and not as complicated and adversarial. Yet people today seem to be going about their business despite these madcap, unbelievable things that are being, you know, perpetrated on us by the government. It kind of feels like 1954, people are just, you know, brushing it off, adapting to it, and whether it be Ukrainians, what they did to the Polish in prior to World War II and after the Nazis invaded.
Yeah, I mean, look, Dave, the list of in-group, out-group, or tribal conflicts is, you know, it's endless. I mean, we could do like a 24-hour show on it, but... The point is how are we going to go forward, you know,
I just want to point out the hypocrisy. For example, France, when they were taking over Algeria and colonizing it, during that time, they killed maybe 750,000. And yet, in 1865, France had the idea of giving, you know, United States the Statue of Liberty. And they, you know, they put it together, and during the time that they were colonized, at the same time they were giving us the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, you know, I gotta tell you that kind of schizophrenic or split personality in governments, you know, I don't mind that as much, because I think it's okay to have an aspirational side, even if in practice you're not there.
Yeah, but you're celebrating, you're giving us a monument to celebrate the freedom, you know, look at the Statue of Liberty, breaking the chain, and at the same time they're torturing, killing, murdering, and bringing the French people over to Algeria to decimate the population. It's fascinating. No, I think that's fascinating. And still to today, France will never apologize for killing about 1 million people.
Yeah, well, colonialism in general, you know, is something that obviously an apology isn't gonna fix it. You know, we have to fix it economically. We have to take responsibility.
That's my point. Somehow we go on despite the horrific events.
Yeah,
but Algeria is thriving. You know, after the Allies took over Germany, Russia, and the about 1 million women were raped by the Russian soldiers. Still, they persevered, and the good things came out of it somehow.
Yeah.
Human condition is something that can tolerate and adapt to horrific events.
Well, yes. But where we are is unprecedented, and for that reason. We can't continue doing what we were doing. Listen, Dave, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Call us again. And our number is 212-209-2877. Elaine, what do you think?
Well, I think Dave mentioned some really interesting points there, and it made me think, I hadn't considered this for a little while, that some of the groups that were at each other's throats, killing each other in the Second World War, are now such firm allies. I mean, we're close allies with Germany, with Japan. As he said, we adapt.
Yeah.
We adapt and we form new alliances, and we find that we've got common interests.
Yes, absolutely. And, what we've seen is the tribal identities have had, to some extent, disastrous effects in the last 100 years, because the closer we get to the modern, technological age that we're in, the more that those kinds of conflicts are just disastrous. Groups embracing their tribal identities often withdraw from participating in broad-based political coalitions in favor of focusing only on issues that affect their individual group. This is known as identity politics. The narrowing of political focus, characteristic of identity politics, makes posing a serious challenge to the underlying system of domination unlikely. For example, identity politics tends to splinter groups who might otherwise unify in large numbers around issues of class. Tribalism and identity politics can be obstacles to gaining the unity and cooperation needed to successfully deal with our existential crises.
How does unionization come into that?
Unions
sometimes cross those lines.
Yeah, but when unions cross those lines, that's when unions became much more effective, because there was a time that, you had to be white to be in certain unions. And there was a time that was no longer true. And those unions were able to become much larger coalitions by giving up their identity politics and their racism.
And the dominant forces have worked so hard to disrupt that.
Absolutely. Tribal narratives often create an exaggerated sense of separation and distinctiveness. conveying that one's own tribe is differentiated from the rest of humanity by numerous desirable characteristics, such as being the bravest, the smartest, the best looking, the most righteous and devout, and the most deserving. Many groups teach that despite possessing such praiseworthy qualities, or sometimes precisely for having them, they have suffered grave injustice, subjugation, persecution, or other injury. Such identity narratives ferment anger, indignation, and aggrievement, and sometimes they've led to calamitous results. So early indicators of the disastrous potential which tribal thinking can have in the modern world go back to the start of the 20th century. Throughout Europe and Asia in the late 19th and early 20th century, several political movements built around nationalist identities recreated histories which frequently exaggerated a group's homogeneity and the supposed continuous oppression they suffered. And these movements are ultimately what set the stage for what came to be then the deadliest war in human history, the First World War, and that title as the deadliest only stood for a mere 21 years until a renewed round of national identity movements resulted in the even more deadly Second World War. Our number is 212-209-2877, and if you can contribute to our discussion about tribalism, if you have some ideas about it, or how we can get past it, or what it means to you personally in your life, give us a call, 212-209-2877. Elaine, what do you think?
I keep thinking of the word that you use, in naturalistic support, blame.
Yeah.
The blame is such a key issue. And yet the flip side of it is cooperation, shared interest.
Yeah. Yeah, blame is absolutely what's tearing us apart. I mean,
As you say, right now the threats facing us, if we don't overcome that, are so great.
Yeah. Also, another factor in the tribalist thinking is kind of not really thinking through who do I really identify with. You know, we were talking about that, how few grandchildren or great-grandchildren identify more with their grandparents' culture than they do the culture of their peers. And as an extension of that thought, there's an exercise that we can try. Going to ask the listeners if they want to participate. Get a piece of paper and a pencil or a pen so you could make a list, or make a list on your phone or computer. Okay, so here's the scenario. Let's imagine that we're stranded somewhere, that you are stranded somewhere. You could imagine the classic desert island scenario, or it can be someplace else, any place you prefer. The key factor is that you're stuck in this place for an unknown period of time, could be days, could be weeks, perhaps even much longer, and you have limited company, let's say about 20 others. Okay, so now given these circumstances, you get to pick the most important characteristic of your fellow strandees. And so that our choice won't be constrained by practical considerations like having excellent survival skills, for this exercise, let's make the assumption that all possible candidates would be equal in their survival aptitude. So without concern for survival skills, what would be the most important characteristic of your fellow strandees? And there's a bunch of questions.
I'm so glad you took out that survival skill part.
Yeah.
We used to play this game in our family and with friends, and my husband was always the first choice.
Yeah, he was pretty handy.
He could do everything.
He was pretty handy. Yep.
And I was kind of the last one.
I hear you. So okay, would it survival skills aside, would you choose people who share your religious affiliation as the most important? Or what about people who share your skin color? Or people whose great-grandparents came from the same country as your great-grandparents? And what about people who share your taste in music? People around your own age? People who share your political ideas? People with a great sense of humor? People who are excellent communicators? People who can keep a lid on their temper? People who can think clearly and deeply? People who are highly empathetic? People who smoke or used to smoke marijuana? Or any other characteristic that you'd care about the most? It might be reasonable to think that those people who possess the characteristics you've picked, that those are your people. Those are your tribe. So if you joined us in this exercise, call us and tell us which characteristic you would pick or that you picked. And our number is 212-209-2877, and we do have a caller on the line. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Where are you calling from, and who's calling?
Good afternoon. I'm in Nassau County. This is Attila, as we say in Hungarian.
Hey, Attila.
How you doing?
Yeah, good, good, good. Haven't heard from you in a while. What do you think of the topic?
Someone with a major in anthropology, I thought this was a good time to give a response.
Yes.
What you guys were discussing. I believe, first of all, I've had to deal with a lot of identity politics, which you mentioned earlier. One parent is from Europe, the other one's from America, although my grandparents were from Europe originally on that one side that was born here as far as my mom. Anyway, the world has always been the way it is as far as humans. We evolved the way we did. Our instincts will always be the same. Our needs will always be the same, and that's the issue. Do we concentrate on our needs? Or do we concentrate on everything else? And that's the problem. And we have to keep fighting that instinct to battle one another. Although that has helped us to survive infighting. We're humans. We have this huge brain, supposedly, that's supposedly so advanced. But
yeah, so Tilla, what do you think is going to work? Because look, if we can't come up, if we can't even imagine a solution, I mean, we, you know, this is only a 1 hour program, we're not going to implement a solution, but if we can't even imagine one, then what are we saying, that it's hopeless and we're just going to annihilate each other?
The response to that is, it does look like we're headed towards more types of wars now, of course, which are highly digital. And that's bringing us down, literally. I believe that's what's causing a lot of the problems with the aeronautical systems, because it's just too much digital. So we have to realize we've got to just do something different. We've got to. We can't survive like this much longer.
Yeah. Well, you know, what we're trying to suggest is maybe part of that is just questioning this whole tribal thing to begin with. Maybe we need to draw new lines and recognize that, you know, there are a lot more important things than people who are the same skin color as me or the same religion. I mean, it's not to say that we don't have to take on oppression and discrimination, but it needs to be universally taken on, because, you know, if we're just concerned with fighting the battle that our group is fighting, it's not going to be effective. We have to wipe out oppression and discrimination everywhere it rears its head.
Understood. I agree. Absolutely. That's in and of itself the issue, because our ancestors, if they were too complacent and took too long to think, we would have been destroyed and killed off by the big cats of Africa.
Yeah.
We don't want to take time. We can't take time. I mean, it's not our instinct to take that time to think,
to be like what may, some may say, oh, we're too wishy-washy. We're too conservative. We're too on the line of things. We're on the fence. We're not making decisions. So that's the issue. We want to make decisions to do right. Then some of us make decisions too fast without really thinking it through for humanity as a whole. That's it, you know, and survival, you know, it's a big, big issue, of course.
No, absolutely. And, you know, the thing is that there is like some hopeful stuff going on. I mean, there, you know, the current administration notwithstanding, we were moving in what was probably a pretty good direction. You know, the conversations that were taking place in schools, in offices, in workplaces of all kinds, in other institutions, kind of, you know, looking at things like microaggressions and exclusionary behaviors and things that we take for granted, and but things that hurt people. You know, this country was really trying to do some cutting-edge stuff with trying to take that on. And, you know, albeit we're backsliding right now, but I don't, you know, I don't think this can last.
It won't. Not for America, at least. We were founded on the separation of powers and all that. And once again, you know, tribalism is pretty blatant in the federal government.
Yeah.
They don't want to. Well, they're doing what they think is right. But the majority, as per approval ratings, is saying, no, this is wrong. How are you doing it?
I mean, who even knows if they think what they're doing is right? They might realize, you know, the error of their ways. But there's this, you know, machine that just drives forward, and it's mindless and it's kind of ugly. And
absolutely, and it's spelled CONTROL.
Yeah, it's all about control, and I hear you.
Yeah,
Attila, thank you for your call, and call us again.
You.
Okay,
we'll
good to speak with you. Thanks. What do you think, Elaine?
He's put his finger on the tough parts of it, but we need each other. I keep thinking of those people that the current administration have blamed for so much.
Yeah.
I'm really worried about the fruit supply in my supermarket. I want people who are farming and who are harvesting. And he's decimating that workforce.
Yeah.
It's not giving jobs to anybody, and it's taking food out of our mouths.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's just anybody.
You know, it's hard to believe that there aren't plenty of people who are trying to be truth tellers, but they're just getting drowned out. You know, they're not like the first Trump administration where truth tellers seem to get an ear. That right now, the administration is deaf to truth.
His entire way of holding power seems to be blame.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to have to take this up again next week, because I think there's a lot more to say about this topic, and we want to hear more from listeners as well. So I think we're going to wrap it up.
That goes so fast.
It does. It does when you're having fun. You've been listening to Naturalistic Support. I'm Arnell Doré. Joining me today was Elaine Durbach. Thanks to our engineer Rich Johnson and to Hilla Weiss for her support. Tune in again next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for another edition of Naturalistic Support. Archived editions of our program can be found on our website at wbai.org and at equaltimeforfreethought.org. Hi to my foster mom, Marilyn. And remember, always try to be kind, because you never really know what someone else is going through.